Thank you, Steve, and really want to make, I guess I'm the setup man for the greatest congressman, my congressman, Congressman Danny Davis. And he is an amazing person who has been on the battle, as the song in the church says, been on the battlefield for a long time. And some of the things that I'm going to present or talk about will be things that Congressman Davis will be able to embellish a lot more, particularly from the policy point of view. So let me just say that I'm grateful to be on this panel, and I thank Joe as its moderator and my colleagues, Drs. Kittles and Martin, for their presentations. And I'd like to pick up on a point that Dr. Kittles made, talking about epigenetic factors. And in his slide, he indicated that one of the epigenetic factors was food. And so food, like medicine, probably has different impacts and different actions on persons based on their genetic predisposition. At least that's what I understood you to say, Rick. So it makes sense to me that food, which is, those of you who know me lately, has been my passion to talk about, and the place where food is also an important point. So I want to talk about food and the environment. And I decided, rather than to try and go forward with more things, really to go back. And so one of the things that, when I came to the Chicago Department of Public Health as its commissioner in 2006, Ms. Mari Gallagher's company was at that point releasing this study that many of you have heard about, talking about food deserts. But one of the things that, when I thought about putting this talk together, that I decided to go back and look at Dr. Mari Gallagher's work was to look at the words of Dr. Kaplan, who wrote the foreword for that study. And if we look at that particular statement, what we have come to make popular about Mari's study is this notion of talking about food deserts where there are no grocery stores, where there is a lack of green foodstuffs. But the thing that I think that was most important about that, which was missed by most people, was that she also, in his foreword, he talked about the noun, which is what everybody talked about. But to me, the real substance of that talk was about the verb. And the verb focuses on the action. In other words, these places were not just food deserts. These were deserted communities. And when we think of them as deserted communities, then it makes sense that it's not only just food deserts that are absent, but a number of other agencies that are absent. And this particular word, or the word, looking at the word desert as a desert as a verb, focuses on what we call action and agency, saying that none of these things were natural or an accidental phenomenon, that indeed it is the result of decisions made at multiple levels by multiple actors. That is, policy decisions about housing, policy decisions about welfare, policy decisions about funding of schools, policy decisions about availability of mortgages had more to do with the creation of these deserts than what we originally thought about. And I thought it was important for me now to go back into this and take a look at this in a different sort of way. So when we look at the food, what we call the food deserts that Mari talked about, these are nearly exclusively African American. Well, why? And perhaps my esteemed congressman will be able to help enlighten us on some of the policies that were put in place. But I can remember, as a child growing up, seeing the transition of welfare policies, particularly as a result related to age-dependent children, and housing policies, particularly those that built those what are now gone called projects throughout the city of Chicago, which were really containment areas for folks that were migrating up from the south. But if we look at these particular tracks, she talks about that there were really difficult problems accessing food in those areas, and we'll talk about that in a minute. To Dr. Kittle's point again about body mass index, when we look at these areas of the city, and for those of you This is the lake right here. So this is north, this is south, this is west, and this is east. You can clearly see where we have congregations and large congregations of what we call African Americans living on the west and south side that we see concomitant high BMIs, much like what my colleague Dr. Kittles described earlier. But we also look at food balance scores, and that is the relative accessibility of fresh fruits and vegetables with as contradistinction to fast foods. We can see that these particular communities are also out of balance. And this is also represented by looking at this particular slide. When we look at the actual distances, which is what Mari talked about, and we will get into that in a little bit more, that we see that chain grocery stores were far much further away from African Americans and African American communities than others. And that difference was far less when we looked at fast food. This made an important distinction, but more importantly, if we look at the income differences between African Americans, whites, Latinos, and what we call diverse, which are other populations, but you can see that the income gap is wide. Now, that has implications for where grocery stores are located. Those of you who've been to Whole Foods know that it's a significant investment to be able to shop in those grocery stores. And when she looked at years of potential life lost to diseases like cancer, what we call cardiovascular disease and what we call diabetes, that the years of potential life lost due to these particular areas also mimicked the areas where we had large concentrations of African Americans, where we had high cancer rates, where we had high cardiovascular disease rates, and where we had high diabetes rates. It should not be a surprise that these things all follow one another with regard to obesity and high BMI. And if we looked at mothers, if we looked at the highest concentrations of single mothers with children under age 18, we can see also these same kinds of overlaps. The same kinds of overlaps in the same parts of the city where we have African Americans concentrated. And I'll get to that in just a moment. And if you look at this particular track over here, it's pretty much the same track. So what does all this mean? Well, the real question is, why did this happen? What policies created? What were the politics that were going on at the time? That guided the distribution of wealth, which is what we call economy, and then the racial politics using the surrogate of skin color as a way to define these populations. So, and Patrick Sharkey, in a book called Stuck in Place, made this statement that the generation of African American children raised during the civil rights era has made virtually no advancement outside of the nation's poorest neighborhoods. And this is a real indictment on social mobility that has other implications, as we'll get to in a minute. So if we looked at median income in 1960 versus 2010, nearly a 50-year span, you can see that the median income for African Americans still trails that of what we call white Americans by almost half. And if we look at the poverty rate in 1960 versus 2011, we can see that the poverty rate for blacks at that time was nearly 30% in 1960, and a little under 7.5% for whites. But we see in 2011 that poverty rate has increased up to 34% for blacks and about 10.9% for whites. If we look at segregated neighborhoods, in 1960, 69% of African Americans lived in communities that were pretty much African American. That was 94% black. And in 2011, it's not significantly changed. That we're still in these communities that are predominantly African American. And if you look at the unemployment rate, as I mentioned before, you can see that the unemployment rate still is almost it's almost triple. That is a little under triple than it is for whites between 1968 and 2012. So the conditions that breed the kinds of inequities that we see and the kinds of policies that we're actually even facing today as we're dealing with the governor who is setting up the absolute destruction of much of the social fabric and the social programming that has helped a number of the people, a lot of these people who depend on those things to be able to work as part of their condition for welfare. And those programs are eroded. And so what will that do? So Dr. King said America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. So these are the things that I think are the kinds of discussion, as we always talk about food deserts, but we opt out of the discussion about the desertion of communities at an economic, political level that drives the kinds of things that we see. And so just to show that this was structural, we have to remember that there were laws passed throughout the city of Chicago where white property owners were prohibited to sell or rent to black people. This is what created the ghettos and the concentration of people in these neighborhoods. It was not by choice. It was not by choice. And blacks did try to go into some of those areas. Black folks, as Dr. King found out when he came here, when he was hitting the head in the brick, as he was trying to march down some of these communities, there was those that many people were met with violence. I want to just take a pivot now to talk about something else, because we all would agree that education is absolutely critical to thinking about some kind of upward mobility. So if we looked at the state of Illinois, and these are data that you can go to the IllinoisReportCard.gov, and you can go get the data for yourself. But if we look at the ISAC scores, these are the Illinois State Achievement Test scores, the PSAE, the Prairie State Achievement Exam scores. For the state of Illinois, you can see that just a bit over 55% of the students in public schools in the state of Illinois are meeting or exceeding those tests, the expected results. But you look at the graduation rate, it's 86% statewide, and the readiness for college is about 46%. Which is to say, when I was in school, and I don't know about you, but a 46 on an exam was a what? It was an F. Period. And if we look at specifically now, District 299. So when you go to the website, if you put in District 299, that gives you the city of Chicago and all of the schools within the city of Chicago. So if you look at the PSA, the Prairie State Achievement Test, the 37% of the students in the state, in the city of Chicago, meet or exceed the scores required for the PSAE. We have just under 400,000 students that are enrolled. We have an 81% graduation rate, but only 27% based on the readiness for college as defined by that likelihood of achieving a 21 or more on the ACT exam. I would say that 27% in most of the tests that I would take and you would take would be an F. So I wanted to dig a little deeper, particularly because if education was one of the things that helped us with our upward mobility, let me look at some of the schools. And every single school in the district is located on this map. And you can then click on any one of those to get that sort of overview picture. But what I did was I was asked, because I was part of the Black History Makers, to go back to my high school to offer some words of encouragement to the students. And I really felt extremely conflicted about being able to go back to the school because I was trying to figure out what the hell was I going to say. Because when I look at my school, and the school that I graduated from was Chicago Vocational, it's called Career Academy now. But if you look at, it's a 9 through 12, but look at the number of students that meet or exceed the requirements for entry into college. 5.5%. 5.5%. So what was I supposed to tell these students about their likelihood to be able to be a physician or a nurse or a doctor? Am I supposed to tell them that they're supposed to somehow pull themselves up and recreate what the system failed to do, which was to educate them? How was I supposed to reconcile this kind of difference? How was I supposed to then look at the fact that, yes, we're in food deserts, we're in communities that have been deserted, and then we're not preparing the next generations of children to even escape the segregation of the neighborhoods they live in, the poverty that they live in, or the educational prisons that they live in that serve to feed this federal prison system? Because you may or may not know that 91% of all of, the federal prison system that are owned privately have contracts with the federal government that if the occupancy drops below 91%, that the federal government will pay them for every bed that's empty. We have 5%, and I'm going to get into Michelle Alexander's discussion, but we have 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the incarceration, overwhelmingly African American and Latino. America is the only country in the world where more men are raped than women. So when we look at these kinds of things, it's clear to me that these students are primed and ready to enter into a life of crime that will buy them tickets into these federal penitentiaries, where, thanks to people like Bill Clinton and others, the sentencing is so harsh that these people will never see the light of day, and even after serving 30 years in prison, will not be able to come out and extricate themselves from the title of being a felon, and permanently then disbarred from all kinds of opportunities that would allow them to move up the social ladder. But let's not stop here. Now, we have some schools where there are glimmers of hope. These are the selective enrollment schools where you can see these numbers. But the school that got interest to me was the school where the people were going on a hunger strike in order to save the school. And that was Dyett High School. And if you look at Dyett, it had a 1.4% readiness level for college. 1.4%. So I say this to say that we've got a lot of work to do, and we are where we are because it is planned. It was purposeful for it to be so. And I'll stop there and leave now the rest of the discussion to our distinguished Congressman, Congressman Davis. Were you coming? Come up, Joe, to introduce? Just the slides. Okay. Thank you.